globalization is in many ways the World Wide Web. And yet, spiritually, we see underneath that, that interconnectedness is something that, that we as Christians and as a faith community have known for a long time. Sociologists look at globalization in terms of the intersection of multiple societies. And anthropologists really talk about the McDonaldization of world culture or the Walmartification of the global arena, and you know how really we see this gradual homogenization of everything that's sort of in many ways diminishing and erasing a lot of native cultures, but in replacing with what is often a North American, European, and often financially focused culture and commercial culture. But underneath that, theologians and people who are here today, people of faith, are really trying to say globalization also presents the opportunity for human solidarity like we've never seen before. And we've seen major international disasters that have mobilized global networks to respond like we've never seen before. And so there is a capacity to work together within this global network that is truly extraordinary. But at the same time, Robert Schreider, as he tries to summarize it, he says we really don't have a commonly accepted definition of globalization, nor is there a consensus on its exact description. But all would agree, however, that it's about the increasingly interconnected character of the political, economic, and social life of the peoples of the planet. So in some sense, this issue of connectedness is really at the core of our lives. It's at the core of our spirituality. It's at the core of our faith and our ministries. It's really at the core of what it means to be human. But as we really take that call to connectedness, it really takes a while to ponder a bit our current situation in the world order today. So just for starters, if we were to really look at our population today, that on our planet, we have almost 7 billion people today who are living on planet Earth. And that's a big number. That's a big number. Even a theologian like myself, I don't really know how to imagine that number that big. So really, I find it easier to say that if you were to proportion that 7 billion and put that into a village of 100 people, this is what the demography of our world would look like. 61 in our global village of 100 are from Asia. 10 are from Europe. 15 are from Africa. 14 are from the Americas, and less than 1%, but for argument's sake, and to really dignify our Australian colleagues who are here today, that they, you count, you matter to us, you're very important to us. So you are on the map, you register. So wonderful countries. So, but here's something extraordinary too. If you look at global income and wealth, the numbers get rather staggering. So these numbers actually just really have been, I'll get into these, but many of these were just refined by an Axiom report that came out last week. But when economists look at the world as it is today, there are two ways of measuring sort of these economic variables. One is income in terms of how much people make in a defined period of time, in this case, within a particular day. Wealth is what the cumulative assets that one has over the course of one's life, one's total savings, property, whatever else they may have. Currently, of the 7 billion people in the world on the left, you can see it on the right, you see the percentages, that right now 19% of the world lives on less than $1.25 a day. 48% of the world lives on less than $2 a day. 75% of the world lives on less than $10 a day. 95% of the world lives on less than $33 a day. And the top 5% of the world lives on more than $33 a day. So if you make more than $33 a day, you are in the top 5% earning income of the world. Now, in terms of wealth, these are the numbers in terms of how people's cumulative assets are really kind of congregated here. So just a little more than $2,000. Half the world has a little more than $2,000 to their name. These numbers go up increasingly. And if we go to this next... here, 14,000, 90% of the world has only a little more than 14,000 to their name, right? 95% of the world has a little more than 60,000. 99% of the world has just a little more than 150,000 to the name. So if you think about the value of your house, your auto, again, any stocks, or if you are have more than $150,000 to your name, you are in the top 5% of the world. But this top 1% has $500,000 or more. So this top 1% of the world Now, this statistic came out last week. The richest 1% of the world will have as much wealth as the other 99% by 2016. Right? Top 1% of the world will have as much as the other 99% by 2016. Now, these numbers are really rather striking as well. The top, the richest individuals, the three richest individuals in the world, so this goes back and forth between Carlos Slim, between Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, the three richest people in the world have as much as the poorest 48 nations. But the top richest 80 people in the world have collectively as much wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion people, or half the world's population. Right? And as we kind of carry this out even further to get the sense of this snapshot, right now, in a village of 100 people, 15 would be undernourished. One would be dying of starvation. Four would not have access to adequate sanitation. 11 would not have access to adequate drinking water. 23 would live in substandard housing. 17 would not have access to electricity. 16 would be unable to read. Only 7 out of 100 would have a college education. 11 would have an automobile. 40 would have access to the internet. And 22 would own or share a computer. So these numbers, as we begin to look at them, begin to raise questions. But one of the ways we begin to look at our values, personally and collectively, is also see how we spend our money. So this chart shows the amount of money that we spend on different items, in terms of fragrances, pet care, international development aid. One thing I want to highlight on this, the international development aid number, that right now there's $135 billion. This is what wealthy nations give to poor donor nations for development. The amount of money in remittances that migrants give to their home countries, as we know, migrants are often working in the lowest paying jobs, but they sacrifice even the little that they make to help families back in their homelands. They spend more than $300 billion in terms of remittances. So what that means that actually migrants, if relatively speaking here, we could say that migrants actually spend almost three times as much sending money to the developing countries as wealthy donor nations do. So rather striking. It's the widow's mite on steroids. I mean, it's just sort of very much writ large. But we see what we send on narcotics, alcohol, tobacco, luxury market. Right now, the military spending worldwide is approaching $1.8 trillion. Now, these statistics are really rather striking because, to just put this in really perspective, for less than one day's military spending, we could virtually eliminate malaria in Africa. For what we spend in 2 days on the military, we could provide the healthcare services necessary to prevent the deaths of 3 million infants a year. And for less than a week's worth of military spending, we could educate each of the 140 million in developing countries who have never attended school. So there's sort of many questions that this data raises, but one that I really want to ultimately come down to is really an inner question. There are structural issues that obviously are being addressed that you will be addressing in these days. There are issues of distributions of wealth, inequalities, even legal issues that really often can even legalize injustice and make it. But the issue that I want to focus on here is really what's going on inside. And what Vatican II said, Gaudium et Spes, is that somehow the disorders out there are related to disorders inside of us. And so in Gaudium et Spes, it has this beautiful quote, which is, I've somewhat paraphrased here to take out the sexist language, but this is what it says. It says, "The truth is that the imbalances under which the modern world labors are linked with that more basic imbalance which is rooted in the heart of human beings, where many elements wrestle with one another. Thus, on the one hand, as creatures, we experience our limitations in multiple ways. On the other, we feel ourselves to be boundless in our desires and summoned to a higher life. Pulled by manifold attractions, we're constantly forced to choose among them and renounce some. Indeed, as weak and sinful beings, we often do what we would not and fail to do what we should. Hence, we suffer from internal divisions, and from these flow so many and such great discords in society." So this is really a profound sort of way of looking at justice, because it really is saying that somehow there has to be a reordering of the human heart in order to really work at the issue of justice. And so if we really are paying attention, if we really are reflecting on our lives, we recognize that within our own hearts there's also a reordering that needs to happen, even as we go forth and work for social change outside of us. When I was in the seminary, I spent some time working with cancer and heart attack patients in a hospital in Colorado Springs. And every day when I would do my pastoral care rounds, I'd go into people's rooms and they would show me their battle wounds of the heart surgeries they'd gone through. And they'd show me their legs where they had taken the veins out to do coronary bypass. They'd show me the scars that they had on their chest from the surgeries that they had. And after seeing a number of patients over a period of time, I finally asked one of the doctors if I could actually watch the process of an open heart surgery. And it was really remarkable because not only did they allow me to do that, but I can remember just coming in this room and then coming to the front of the operating table there. And there was a team of maybe about 10 or 12 nurses. And there were three doctors, two surgeons, and then another anesthesiologist who was really taking care of it, oxygenating the blood while they brought the beating heart to a complete stop. And as I saw doctors go through this incredible process of removing the blockages of this one person's heart, I was amazed by two things. One was the extraordinary skill of the surgeons. But the second was the miracle of the human heart in and of itself. And this is something that is something that we take for granted. And this is something that the ancient religious traditions really have named so well, from Mesoamerica to Christianity, which is that the human heart is a physical organ with a mystical quality. It's the source of our deepest desires. It's the place of our greatest realizations of true knowledge, but it's also the place of our deepest conflicts and struggles. And so it is because it is also the funneling point from which we connect to our relationships. And it's those relationships that really are at the heart of this analysis. And before getting into that, though, in order to really, I think what God is calling us to, continues to call us to, is not just a heart bypass, but really a heart transplant. And we see this in Ezekiel, we see this in Jeremiah, we see this even throughout Jesus, where really what he's offering people is a new heart, a heart of flesh, a heart that feels, a heart that's able to be sensitive to the suffering of those who are crying out in need. And so the wonderful theme of this conference is encountering Christ in the heart of the world. And as I kept thinking about this theme, I kept thinking about encountering the heart of Christ in the world, and really allowing our own hearts to be transformed by that very love which is given to us. But to do that, we need to get a new frame for what the economy is all about. Is that we tend to think that the economy is all about financial transactions. But from God's perspective, the economy is not just about the movement of capital. The economy is ultimately about something much richer. The Greek word is really economy was about the arrangement of a household. Economy meant how a household was arranged. So you economize a household by arranging it according to the needs of each of its members. This meant that the early churches, they looked at their own place in the world and in the universe before God. They recognized that really it was about reflecting on really collectively the ordering of God's households. You know, there's really, in some sense, we're never fully owners. Catholic social teaching says this. We're never fully owners of anything. That when we die, we have to give it up. And if that's the case, we're best stewards and not owners. And so the question is, how do we really arrange the household and be stewards of what we've been given, rather than come to think of the illusion that we actually own what we have? And so what the focus of the church is really not just on financial costs, but indeed human costs. And so therefore, God's economy is really oriented around what Jesus' central focus was. And Jesus' central focus was about the kingdom of God. It's about a kingdom of truth and life, of holiness and grace, of justice, of love, and of peace. The church has a role in that kingdom, but the church is not the kingdom. The church actually proclaims that kingdom and waits for the fulfillment of that kingdom. But in the end of the days, this is really what the church is about, is really proclaiming that kingdom. So really the mission then of the church is really trying to find the path of peace. So let me just see if I can collectively summarize really up until this point, really what the major image is. So the question would be this. That if we look at our collective disorders and we look at the path we're following, we can either shipwreck on the icebergs of greed or we can find our way to the promised land of human solidarity. And so the question is, how do we begin to navigate our way to that place? How do we begin to navigate our way to the path of peace? All right. So let me see if I can put this in visual form. Now, this is a kind of a Leonardo DiCaprio-esque image, all right? So We are in a time of titanic change, okay? There are some people who have kind of luxury seats on the upper ship of the deck, or the upper deck of the ship. But whether we shipwrecked on these icebergs or whether we really find our way to really our connection with one another is really going to depend on how we navigate. So let's take this image a little further. All right, now, one of the things globalization has given us is an incredible capacity to find our way through time and space. So yesterday, I came from Northeast Pennsylvania. I put in the Omni Hotel into my iPhone. Magically, it somehow told me where to turn and where to come, and I appeared here and even told me what time when I would arrive. So we have just an amazing ability to navigate today, and we can do this through different ways. We can do this through sonar, by looking at the territory underneath the ocean surface. We can look at it through radar by looking at the territory in front of us on the ocean surface. And we can look at it through a GPS by reading the signals from above. Right? Now here's the corollary thinking here, is that this is kind of a way to think analogously of how we try to find the way to navigate in our own collective and personal lives. Sonar, I hope you can see this down here. There is under self there. It's really trying to look at human nature. So that little green bar there should say human nature. That, and in the end of the day, the reason why we reflect on tradition and theologize and philosophize and these other things is try to say that underneath the ocean surface, we're still human beings and things haven't changed that much. And in that process, really, one of the ways we navigate is just through self-knowledge and getting a deeper sense of that self-knowledge. And this is by no means an easy thing. I mean, it's remarkable that we're so plugged in, connected to iPhones, on terminals, watching video things, but really in terms of reading our inner lives, it's often a foreign land. I think we spend so much time, even in universities, teaching people about materials of all sorts, but one of the most neglected areas of knowledge is self-knowledge. And so it's a very, very important very important element of navigation. If you will, understanding divine nature is its own God positioning system, its own type of GPS. And this is really what Revelation is trying to do, is say, what is God saying to us in this time and space? Radar is trying to get us in touch with our social nature and our physical nature as well. So, in the end of the day, what we're really talking about is relationships and how to get our relationships right. So, what justice is about, from a theological vision, is about getting our relationships right. All right. So really the deepest meaning of righteousness, biblical righteousness, is not about self-righteousness. It's ultimately about getting our connections right. And when our relationships are not right, we're not right. I mean, chances are if you got into a fight with your husband or a good friend before you came here, chances are you're probably not fully here. Because when our relationships are not right, something inside of us is just amiss. And that's why Jesus came, is because sin sort of took us off kilter and really put this kind of division in our relationships. And the primary purpose why he came was to bring us back into right relationship again. And so when we do our work in our ministries in social justice, what we need to do then is to think in stereo. All right. What we need to do is think in stereo. So for those of the older members of the group here, we knew what AM radio was like. All right. And so those younger folks don't know what AM radio was, but it was, you know, a different experience. And, you know, if we're only looking at just financial analyses or just political perspectives or just social perspectives, we're just thinking in AM radio. That's it. But what Hans Walter Wolf said is that what we need to do is stereometric thinking, he said. We need to think about our relationships on multiple levels. And these levels have to do with ourselves, with others, with the environment, and ultimately with God. And that somehow we've got to be able, we're embedded into these relationships. And because we're embedded in these relationships, we need to be able to think in stereo through these relationships through this whole thing. So, but more to the coordinates, okay? So, if we have this big challenge of saying there is a promised land out there is a way to navigate, my heart is important in that navigation, I don't know where to find the coordinates to navigate, and I don't want to know what instruments to read because there are a lot of different instruments being given me in social media and other ways that are also trying to steer me in a direction. So we have a great gift in our Catholic Church, in our Catholic social teaching, by saying there are documents here that give us a way of navigating, give us some help in the navigation process. Doesn't mean it answers every question, but it does give us a way of trying to refine those coordinates so that we can help move our way in a more life-giving, connected, reconciled, direction. So there are many different documents in Catholic social teaching, and many of you are familiar with them. I only put a sampling of them up here. But from 1891, really up until more recently, although Pope Francis would not necessarily say Evangelii Gaudium is a Catholic social teaching document, when you read it, there are many parts of it that are really very much about the social teachings of the Church. And so there are many different documents. They come from many different popes. They come from many different contexts. They are addressing many different issues. And so the issue is, how do you take all of these themes, or these, if you will, these documents, and begin to kind of get at the central message of what's going on? So as we know, there's anywhere from 8 to 16 or 18 themes that have been done on what these themes are in Catholic social teaching. But I just want to give you my own version of this, all right? And on reflecting on these issues and trying to understand what these common ground is, my argument would be this, is that in its core essence, what is going on in Catholic social teaching, what is really at the essence of the work that we're doing and the reason why we're even here today, is because we are about the proclamation of a God of life, and we are about the building of a civilization of love. Okay, so in the end of the day, that is the core message of Catholic social teaching. But as we take this out a little bit, if we take out of God of life and we put this into a 10-point acronym, we then see that there are, in fact, 10 themes that we can highlight. The first of these is the analysis of reality, which we really just looked at. When so few have so much and so many have so little, we have to look at this reality and say, what does a God of love and life who created us want for our world? And so Karl Barth really said that really what we are called to do as Christians is to have the newspaper on the one hand and the Bible on the other. And so as we look at these together, the second and also very important principle of Catholic social teaching, I think it's at the heart of Christian spirituality, is the gratuity of God as well. I think the most difficult part and the most countercultural element of our Christian faith is gratuity. Think about how much in our society is based on what we learn, what we merit, what we achieve, what we possess, what we are entitled to. All of that has nothing to do with the gospel. That in the end of the day, that Jesus didn't come because we deserved it. Jesus came because God is love. And probably one of the most radical places of human transformation is just standing in that place to believe that we are in fact loved as we are, in our nakedness, in our most authentic and real being, including all that's not yet redeemed. And that is that which is sinful and broken and needing of healing. And to stand in that place of absolute gratuity is the most liberating place to stand in the world. But it's also the most challenging. It's also the most challenging because once we know that we are loved because God is love and not because we earned it, once we know that we're loved, then the call is to then conform our lives to the gift giver. Right? And so this is very important. And this is where I think our ministry is more than just social activism. Our ministry is not just about helping the poor. Our ministry is about really responding to the God who's loved us first. And because God loved us in our poverty, moving out to really help other people who are also poor and in need. What that really then entails is an ordering of society towards the common good. So when we look at this, it's like when we look at our world today, it's like looking at the world through a circus mirror. We see in its distortions sort of something that's really quite a contrast from what the God of life really intends. And so what are you trying to do here in these days? You're trying to work towards that more ordered society that is reflective of God's care and love for the world, which is really a manifestation of the kingdom of God. That's, I believe, what really this group is all about, is working towards that ordering of society. And it is working towards the common good. What is one of the most distressing elements in Congress today? But the lack of the ability to see a common good, the lack of the ability to commit to the common good. Can't we get beyond just partisan politics whose only goal is to defeat the other party or the other person and get to really the issues that really matter? To get to the substance of really what is needed to really make us a more ordered and just society, this is indeed the work of the Church. This is indeed the work of society. But at the core of that, really, at Catholic social teaching, in its essence, is really about the dignity of the human person. And so really, if you look at this, in my work with migrants, one of the things that comes through again and again and again is when I ask migrants, what's the hardest part about being a migrant? Some of them say, you know, I've stowed away in baggage compartments of buses. You know, I have actually crossed mountains and almost frozen to death. I have gone through deserts and almost baked to death. I've gone through for days without food and water and even almost starved to death. But that's not the hardest part. They say the hardest part is when people treat you like you're a dog, like you're the lowest form of life on earth, and like you're no one to anyone. And so when we even think about our own lives, when we experience probably our deepest hurts, it's probably related to some offense to our dignity on some fundamental level. And that's why the church recognizes that at its core, it's concerned about dignity. I kind of had a shrill reaction yesterday when I was reading about the pilot in Jordan who ISIS burned. And it was not just ISIS's action, which completely scandalized me, but it was also the Jordanian response. And as much as I understand the pragmatic retaliation against ISIS, that the statement was that the life of the ISIS people are in no way equal to the life of this one pilot. And that's not the same thing as what Christianity believes, is that every person, even the most heinous person, has dignity before God. It is really one of our most important proclamations and one of the most important things that everyone's hungry for. So within this framework, really I want to say that what the church is trying to do then is to protect human dignity. The church is trying to protect human dignity through all of its teachings. It's trying to promote this through homelessness, immigration, euthanasia, capital punishment, abortion. In all of these areas, it's trying to say everyone has worth. So, but if you look at this kind of framework here, this is something that Bill O'Neill, a Jesuit, had shared with me, I think a very, very good framework, is that if you have the common good at the top and you have the individual at the bottom here, or institutions at the bottom, you have different ways of understanding justice. Justice is an interaction or a transaction. Commutative justice, how transactions are really brokered. It's also distributive justice, how the common good gives back to the individual, especially if those individuals are weaker or in need, such as elderly. But also an individual must ask, what is it that I can contribute to the common good? So I can't just say that I have rights or that I'm entitled to something without saying that I'm also called to give back. That's what contributive justice is. So in the end of the day, what Catholic social teaching is doing in this focus on dignity is talking about rights, duties, and procedures through all of its documents in many different ways. Next is the option for the poor. And again, this is not an ideological commitment. This is not just about waving the banner, fighting for justice, fighting for the poor. Again, it's coming out of a sense, out of this gratuity of God. Gustavo Gutierrez taught me this again and again, that really the gratuity of God, the option for the poor, need to be seen together. They're integrally related. Because of what God did to us in our poverty, we are called in turn to our poverty. And this doesn't mean that the poor are holier or better or smarter or more entitled or than anybody else. But we recognize that, and we know those of us who've been on the field working on this for a while, we know that. You know, that they can be ungrateful, they can be selfish, they can be mean, they can be manipulative. But at the same time, that what we see, wherever life is most threatened, there we see the God of life acting. And that's why we too are acting in this way. Next is really about freedom. And really, freedom in this sense is not freedom to do whatever I want. Freedom is about freedom from something and freedom for something. And so we perhaps even our discourse in the United States, when we talk about bringing freedom over to the Middle East, that perhaps we haven't really pondered enough really what the dynamics of freedom are about. But ultimately, it's about freedom to be ourselves. And this is not a minor thing either. Together with many folks in this room from Migration and Refugee Services, and I know Kevin Appleby was just recently over in Iraq, Steve Kalecki and others were just coming back from Iraq. To hear the tales of religious people going through religious persecution right now is extraordinary. I remember when I was in a Bulgarian refugee camp in October, this one person came to me and said, I'm a Christian. He didn't even know who I was. I wasn't wearing a collar. He just says, I'm a Christian. So I said, say more. He said, ISIS came to me and he says, are you a Christian? And he said, yes. And he said, why are you a Christian? He says, because I'm tired of the war. I'm tired of the violence. I want peace, and Christ gives me peace. He said he came back later that evening. They killed his mother, his father, his sister, and his two brothers. Right? just having the freedom to worship is something that we should know by no means take for granted, because there are many people in the Middle East right now and other parts of the world for whom that very freedom is threatened. It is a right, but at the same time, it's a question of how we use our freedom responsibly, especially to help those whose freedom is compromised. So many people in this room are working on the issue of life, from abortion to capital punishment. Many of the tables outside of this room really are looking at this issue. But what Catholic social teaching is saying again and again is that life is a sacred gift from womb to tomb. You know, that no matter how we look at it, no matter how disfigured, that life is a precious gift. How many images have we seen with this current pope, you know, kissing, hugging this disfigured man with, you know, kind of many deformities on his face, and really just reaching to the heart, reaching to the dignity, affirming that life is valuable, affirming that life, even in all of its trial, is something that needs to be supported and animated and nurtured. That really is at the core and is at the cornerstone of Catholic social teaching. But it is important to say that one cannot be for a life issue on one area and against it on another. One cannot be pro-life and for capital punishment. This somehow goes against what Cardinal Bernardino talked about as the seamless garment. The seamless garment, there is inevitable integrated link in all of these issues, and they are all life issues. But you can't be sort of against one life if you proclaim life on the other issue. Even though there's varying distinctions, that there's still an ethic of life that's at the root of all of it. Next is involvement, really looking at participation, sometimes called subsidiarity, that everyone is involved in this. What are you doing here this week? It's going to Congress, talking to people, being involved in the process of social change. All of that is putting Catholic social teaching in action. Next is family, and this is important, that really what is at stake here is not only the family of blood, but the family of humankind. Part of the reasons why the Catholic social teaching would even say that the minimum wage is an important element to look at is because if a person is working three or four jobs, you know, in order to survive, they cannot possibly sustain a family by being present in the way that normally they would need to be. But at the same time, there are bonds of connections that go beyond even our own kind of criteria of blood relationships. And I think ultimately what Catholic social teaching, the vision of it, is saying that we are all interconnected as a family of God. And lastly, really what we're looking at here is the environment. Obviously, increasingly, this is an area of concern. If we don't get issues of the environment right, then we really won't have to worry about any other issues, because we won't have an environment where we can survive. But what Catholic social teaching is, says that the preferential option for the poor is also kind of related to the environment, because it also is about what we will pass on to the next generation. So obviously this has become increasing more important in the times to come. But in the end, as we look at this vision of a God of life, as we look at the mission of a civilization of love, really in the end of the day, it is about globalizing solidarity. It is about sort of trying to look at our interconnectedness and trying to find ways that enhance that interconnectedness so that our relationships can truly flourish. So what John Paul II said is that a globalized economy must be analyzed in light of the principles of social justice, respecting the preferential option for the poor, who must be allowed to take their place in such an economy, and the requirements, very important, for the international common good. For the Church's social doctrine is a moral vision which aims to encourage governments, institutions, private organizations to shape a future consonant with the dignity of every human person. And before I close, I just, as we look at these big picture issues, as we look at sort of these large scale things which need to be addressed, as we look at sort of also our own communities and our own personal lives, and as you yourselves kind of cross, however you do this, over on the other side of the wall to meet the peoples that you respond to and that really are important in your ministries, I wanted to share with you, finally, one learning experience that happened to me that I've reflected on many times. And somebody who really said that as much as this is a major global issue, this is also a very personal issue, and it's something related in the depths of our hearts. But in this experiment of going across to the other side of the wall, one time I remember going to Grand Central Station in New York City. And as you know, it's a very busy place. People are rushing back and forth, often not even noticing each other. And I had some time, but I also wanted to have some conversations with some people. And so that day, I remember just grabbing two cups of coffee, and I saw a woman on the other side of the wall, and she was a homeless woman, and she was kind of slumped over. She had this stringy gray hair, kind of greasy, stringy gray hair. She had this faded blue jacket on. She was just slumped over like a lifeless shell. And so I came over, and I sat down next to her with two cups of coffee and gave her a cup of coffee. And I said to her, I said, "How's your day been?" She goes, "Good." And I said, "What's new?" "Nothing." "How are things?" "Fine." You know, so I thought, this conversation is not going to go anywhere. So I just sat there, and I just drank my cup of coffee, and I watched everybody go by, and no one even noticed us. I mean, we just weren't even there, you know, to anybody. And then, but after about 15 minutes, she looks over at me, and she goes, "Who the hell are you anyways?" Right? So I said, "I'm a priest," and that's all I said. And I actually, what happened followed, I really was surprised because I wasn't expecting this. Suddenly, she just broke down in tears, and she started crying, and she just started sobbing profusely. It's like so many tears that I feel she could have washed Grand Central Station. And I didn't want to touch this moment with words. It was a moment just way too sacred to touch with words, and I really didn't want to get in the way of what God was doing in her life. You know, I just wanted to be present to whatever was going on. And so I waited, and I probably waited another 15 or 20 minutes until she just stopped sobbing. But after she calmed down a bit, you know, things began to transition, and then I looked over and I said, "What is your name?" And she said, "My name is Sarah." And so I said, "Sarah, if you could change one thing in the world today, what would you change?" Right? And I'd like you to just think about that yourself. If you could change one thing in the world today, what would you change? You know, I mean, I had studied my theology, so I had, you know, all kinds of answers of what I thought she would say: change the social structures, change the government, change all the people that have contributed to her homelessness. But she didn't say any of those things. As valid as those issues are, she looked over at me and she says, "If I could change one thing in the world today," she said, "I would change my mind." She says, "I've been filled with such bitterness and hatred that I can't forgive. But if I could let go of the resentment in my heart, I would be a new person." So, my brothers and sisters, thank you for allowing me to share a few minutes with you, and as we go forth, let's continue to be witnesses to the God of life and the building of a civilization of love, whatever may change. Thank you.